We are continuing with the interview with Professor Fila. This is tape 2, side 1.
Where do I start? So the German said to me, hast du schon alles abgegeben? I still had my shoes on. Oh, no. Oh, yeah, sorry. No, I already, I did have my shoes on. So he said, hast du schon alles abgegeben? So I nicked my head. So he asked me again. So I bent down and took my shoe off and spit this $10 gold piece on my hand, kept it on the knees, and I put the shoe on, said, yeah, so now that you see, I already gave her everything. So he went away. I bent down again, put it back on my mouth, took the second shoe off and put it up, and went there to the door where we went to the shower. And the assessment points his finger at my mouth. And I thought he's saying something, and I was scared, stiff. But it was so much lights, the fluorescent lights, that he couldn't tell. And I realized in a second he's pointing to my little mustache. I had a little mustache with a barber forgot to take off. So I stood at attention, I turned around, I went to one of the barbers, or many of them, thousands of people. It was a tremendous bar, a tremendous hall. And I pointed, I nicked him, I didn't know what language he spoke, and I pointed at my mustache, so he took it off. I went back to the same assessment, stood at attention real good. He said, right, and I passed. I went in, and I had to go $10 gold piece. The others, if you would ask me to open my mouth, I would have been shot on the spot. And they did it. They were doing it with every so many. They asked it to open their mouth. It's called the Stichprobe. So I got in there and we passed it with shower. It wasn't any gas. Then we were in the camp. We came into a Zeltlager. There was a part of the camp which were only, what's the word? There were no barracks. There were only tents. That was a temporary thing because we were already professional munition workers, so we just came there to be entlaused, to mean if you have any lice or something, which I don't think I didn't. And then to change uniforms and take everything away from us, which maybe we accumulated, and send us to a different labor camp. So there's, the camp, then the tent camp was run, they said all the camp was run by the inmates. There were people who are members of French government, of Belgian government.
Yes, yes.
Of others, there were, Leon Blum was the Prime Minister, Daladier was there, clergy were there, there were all kinds of great people in that camp. So they were running the camp. There were just, the SS just came in the morning for the roll call, and that was it, never saw them again.
But this camp, this tent camp, it was connected to Buchenwald.
It was Buchenwald.
It was
Buchenwald, just tent camp. And we were never in a barrack, just, thank God it didn't rain. We were there about 10 days.
How about all these famous people, Blum and so on? Were they also in the camp?
I never met them. I don't know.
But you said they were running that camp.
The political prisoners were running it.
Okay.
There were two types. Political prisoners had a triangle, a red triangle. The criminals had a green triangle. And they were trying always to run the camp through the green ones because they could be bribed. The political were high people. They couldn't. But the people with the red bar organized so that they were in the camp. So they said, if you have any traitors here who collaborated with the SS, tell us, we'll make you a democratic court, we'll keep them here. They won't go with you because they'll drink your blood all over again. So somebody got up and said, the chief of the police in camp was one. His name was Kshepitsky, I remember.
Well, that's not
a Jewish fellow. No, he was Jewish. And the other was Tepperman. He was the guy.
Tepperman.
And he was running the magazine with clothes and all. Yeah. Irene introduced me to him then,
yeah,
and when the winter came, I wanted to have a coat. It was called, we had those little things like pajamas. So because I knew Irene and she was a pretty decent girl and nothing to do with it, so he gave me a 3/4 coat, heavy coat.
Yeah.
And I said, how about my brother?
Yeah, I know.
You have it already?
Yeah, you mentioned
okay.
That before.
So I got it for him too, and we were there about 14 months.
Uh-huh. That was.
And then all of a sudden they loaded up some trains. But I went back. I'm already in Buchenwald.
No, I know you were already okay.
All messed up. Well, so they took us from Buchenwald, they took us to Schlieben.
Schlieben.
On a trench, Schlieben, near Leipzig, between Leipzig and Halle.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little East Germany.
That was Schlieben,
S-C-H-L-I-E-B-E-N, Schlieben. There was a factory of bazookas. And there, when we arrived there, the Germans, there were some Germans among us who were prisoners in camp. They were Democrats or Social Democrats. They were also in concentration camp. I remember one was a blockalster. In other words, he was the leader of the block out there. But the block could have had a few hundred people. And he would go to the kitchen and order how many people he has on the block, and he'll get so much food, so much bread, whatever, rations, and so on. So he came to us, said the SS came to him, because Germans, we talked to Germans, they said, we don't have to be afraid. They are businessmen. Mm-hmm. They are looking for dollars and gold. And they are going to give us food for it. They're not going to kill anybody. Not to be afraid.
That was in Schlieben.
In Schlieben. And that was in 1944. Mm-hmm. The Germans already knew they were losing the war. So I had my $10 gold piece. I told the blockhouse, he was a decent fellow. I knew him. He was in his 70s then. He was in camp about 10 years already. So I said, I have a $10 gold piece. What can I get? I said, well, I'll try the best for you.
Excuse me. Do you, by any chance, remember his name?
No. I never knew his name. He was just Blockalster, period. I know he was from East Germany. Later, I'll tell you this later. So I gave him this $10 gold piece, and he brought me, we got for 3 months every day an extra piece of bread, a little bit of marmalade, and every other day a little tiny slice of salami, and $20 paper back. Change. Would you believe it? They were businessmen. I couldn't believe it. I saw 20
of
my brother kept
it. So they wanted the gold. They gave you money.
Yeah, and we have about 3 months we had some extra food. But then the Lager commandant, a big tall SS man, came out once and he called. He's looking for dentists. Not to worry, I need dentists because I want to set up a dental office here. So we saw that they mean business, whatever it was. Two or three people stood forward. They did it. They opened up a dental a room somewhere, and they brought a chair and all this. And the Jewish dentists were getting into the Hitler mouths, fixing their teeth for free. Would you believe it? So I sneaked in once in a while, and they looked at my teeth. Otherwise, I would have had nothing today. That was one thing. Then the Lager commandant came out and said, I need a musician. So I started to tremble. Man knew it, so they pointed at me, so I had to step forward. So he says, I want the group to go to work with singing, and I'll give you the music, you teach them, or you pick those who can sing. And I remember some of the songs. We had to go to singing in the morning to the work.
The old German songs?
Yeah. I remember some of it, I remember. Anyway, and there was one Polen Mädchen, and there was one in Schlieben, Auf Schlieben's Fluren, Fand ich den Tod, so, what the hell, there's so many years.
Yeah.
Those 40 some years. But when I think about it, I can remember it. So that's all it was. Then I got a job as a Holzhacker across from the kitchen. I had a boulder.
But Schlieben, you said, was a factory where they made bazookas.
Bazookas, yeah, that's right.
You weren't working with
them. Not yet. No. I got a job. I some kind figured out how, I don't know, and I got a job in on a hall across from the kitchen. And we were sawing wood, cutting juice up, wood for the kitchen. And there were mates there. We didn't know who they were. They were pushing out those big canisters and said, wash it out. We were giving them wood. Then I heard some of them speak Polish. Mm-hmm. I said, hey, where are you from? One was from Warsaw. Well, I know how to talk a Warsaw girl. Before you knew, she became friends with me, so she said, bring me your manaska, I mean the little container where you get your soup. Put it into an SS container, a big one, and give it to me. I'll bring it. You give it to me after you washed it out, and I'll steal SS food, bring it in that thing, shove it out, tell you to wash it out, you take it in there, and you take yours out, and you have good food. So I had a ball that way. But then they took us away from there, and we got a job. Oh no, wait a minute, they took us away because we created a sabotage. So we created a sabotage. It was a night shift. I was that time of the day shift. I was sleeping on my bunk bed. And about 2 o'clock in the morning, the wall from our barrack just flew out. The whole wall. You know, there could have been about 20, 30 beds there. The whole thing just flew. It was a tremendous explosion. There were hundreds of thousands of tons of ammunition. They created a sabotage, and the Germans couldn't produce a bazooka for about 3 months.
Who took part in that sabotage?
The night shift. I don't know who. Nobody talked to. Nobody mm-hmm. would say it. In case somebody gets caught and beaten to death to say.
Yeah.
Nobody knew it. It happened, period.
tell me something. So there were not only Jews working there, there were Poles and other people.
No, we were, in that camp we were Jews.
Because you said you met this one Polish.
And that was in Majdanek.
Oh, that was in Majdanek.
Majdanek, it was a Pole Majdanek. Thanks to him I got out. He gave me the idea to, you know, that
no,
I said.
No, I mean, here the woman that gave you the SS food, that was
that was in Schlieben.
Yeah, but that was a Jewish girl? Or
no, they were Poles. They were in separate barracks.
Oh, they were in separate barracks.
In separate, we never saw them. Mm-hmm. But it just said contact in the kitchen.
Uh-huh. Do you know if the sabotage was done by Jews or by Poles?
There were no Poles there.
Because
it had to be by Jews.
Oh.
There were only Polish women there who worked in the kitchen. They went to a different part. We never saw them again. And the camp where we were only Jews and a few Germans. Our Lagerster, I mean the leader of our Lager, was a German Democrat. He was a German who was in camp as a prisoner, like we were.
Now, so that means that the sabotage was done by the Jews?
Yeah, right.
Okay, because that's important. That
right. Anyway, so they send in young SS, 18, 19-year-old boys, grew up under Hitler, and they were killers. Every time somebody came from work, you saw white bandaged heads. They were beating like hell, you know, to rebuild everything fast. Then they took me away from that work and they put me to a commando of eight people called Zinshütchenabbau.
To what?
It's in German, Zinshütchenabbau. I'll tell you what it is. A bullet, the Gilzer, how is Gilzer in German? I don't know the names in English. The bullet has the explosive part and
that, the
container. The container has a red dot there with the gun. When it hits that red thing and explodes it, right? So that's called a Zündhütchen.
Zündhütchen.
So we were supposed to take the machinery from that Zündhütchen factory. They didn't want it there for the one reason we don't know. We had to push it to a forest, to a railroad tracks and put them on a flatbeds there. So we were eight people with Blechstang, I don't know the names in English, you know, with some iron bars to push it like this on wheels, so that's how we got it. So I'm working there one day, and it was Christmas, 44. One of our foremen, Lopek was his name, comes to me and says, "Where the hell are you? We're looking for, we thought you run away. I'm looking for you half a day already." I said, "What's the big deal?" They brought a piano from a farmer, and our boys are emptied one of the holes where the last operation of the bazookas was on table, because they put four bazookas in a container, and the German girls put incendiaries, make sure there's no sabotage, and they closed it. So that was on table. So they took the tables out, and our men are building a little stage, and they brought a piano from a farmer. And I told the chief of the camp that we have a concert pianist here. I said, "Are you crazy? They're going to kill me. They don't want people education. What'd you do?" I yelled at him. He said, "Don't worry. I know the guy. I can only help you. Come on. He's waiting."
And that was a German.
Yeah, sure. He was the leader of the camp, but he was in civilian clothes. So I come in. He had a Hakenkreuz here in Lapel. So I come in and said, attention to him, and he looks at me. So, "Spielst du Klavier?"
Yeah.
I already spoke some German.
Yeah.
I picked it up pretty fast. So she played the piano, so I said, "I used to play. Look at my hands, look at the calluses." "Yeah, yeah, show him." He said, "Okay, where'd you study?" "Oh, I don't know what Lopek told him, and I'm afraid to lie."
Mm-hmm.
He said, "They're going to kill me anyway to help you." I said, "Yeah, I graduated conservatory, summa cum laude. I started my career and the war broke out." "Do you play the Moonlight Sonata of Beethoven?" Mm-hmm. So she said, "Yes, sure, I used to play it, you know. Would you like to play it?" I said, "Of course. Well, what can I do? Can only help, I figured." I went up to the stage, I looked at the piano, almost fainted. I beaten up jalopy from a, you know, just a door, you mean from a...
Farmer from...
Yeah, from a farmer, with one pedal. You can imagine what it was. But the slow, and then the slow movement, the first movement is slow. So I played it, and you saw it, I knew it. So he stopped me after I finished the first movement, and he says, "Spielst du die zweite Rhapsodie vom Liszt? Will you play the second Rhapsody from Liszt?" I said, "Now I have a sadist in front of me. Or what technique could anybody play the second?" But the beginning of it is slow, if you know the beginning of it. It goes, ta-dum, ta-dum, ta-da-da-dum, ta-dum, ta-da-da-dum, ta-dum, ta-da-da-dum, ta-dum, ta-da-da-dum, ta-dum, so on. It takes a short while. But while I was playing, there's another German came up to this guy, and they walked away. So I didn't have to play the fast part. I was safe. I went back to my work. But there were rumors going around that those guys, those eight, we looked a little better than the average. Why? Because some of the machinery was not in the factory grounds yet. They were dispersed among different farmers in the Stadoa. How do you Stadoa?
Barracks?
No, it's not a barrack. You know where they keep the hay and all that? Stadoa, okay. Piano like coming from a barn or something. It was a little piece of junk, a real piece of junk. Anyway, but we used to get some of the machinery was still in barns. They didn't bring them yet into the camp, so we had to go there and get them. So we made a 50-50 with a magazineer. We wore two, three shirts. And the farmers were buying them from us. They were giving them us extra food, so we looked a little better because they had some extra food to eat. So the guys in the camp said, oh, these two, they're going to put them to throttle. They were big containers because the bazooka has a head. And the head, you know, the head would penetrate the tank when it's being shot at the tank. So in the head is throttle. That's a chemical, a yellow chemical. And they were boiling it in tremendously big containers, like 2,000-3,000 liters or maybe more. I don't know. You had to go up on a ladder, walk around it. And the fumes were coming out of it.
Yeah.
Germans worked there with gas masks. They worked the day, had 2 days off or something, special food. As they put the way we were, you survive 2-3 weeks, you drop dead, they took other guys. So we were afraid they're going to take us to that work because we looked a little better. So this is going to finish. We'll take all the machinery out. And then what? So after a lunch break, one of our guys comes out of nowhere and says, hey, I got a new job. Because he was worried. He was smart. He went to the fire department and says, I became a fireman. After I'm finished here, I'll be a fireman. So he said, he got something. I'm going to try too because that's the end. So one lunch break, I'm walking through the grounds of the factory, tremendous grounds, and I see the chief who I play the piano for.
Mm-hmm.
He's going this way and I'm going, you know, in each other's direction. I said, now or never.
Mm-hmm.
And I got up to him and I said, attention, my luck was that I spoke German already. And I said, Chef, I played it for your piano 2 weeks ago. Yeah, yeah, was willst du denn? Oh, yeah, what do you want? I said, should I survive the war, I would like to play the piano. I have no other reason to live. My family is already murdered. Could you find me a job where I can save my hands? And I looked him straight in the eye. So he thought for a moment and says, where's thy Meister? Who is your chief? So I told him, it was a guy from Leipzig, was a chemist. Tell him to come to my office. So I ran to the barrack and I told him. So he went over, was there for a while, came back, said, now you go to the office. Oh yeah, later I found out he asked me if I speak German, how I work. He couldn't say anything bad. He tried me out once because we organized a cigarette. So the eight of us would take, everybody would take a puff, it'll go around. So one day I had to go with him
he
to
was
pick.
That guy was my
direct boss,
mm-hmm.
the chemist from
yeah.
Leipzig. So he saw us smoking this one cigarette. So we going to do some work, whatever it was, he takes out a pack of cigarettes. Lights one up, took one puff and threw it right in my trajectory. He figured I'll pick it up.
Mm-hmm.
So I walk, comes the time where the cigarette is there, and I stepped on it, and I just put it out of my foot. So he looks at me and says, rauchst du nicht?
Mm-hmm.
You don't smoke? So the crap which you're throwing away, I don't.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can force me to work, I'm working.
Yeah.
But this is, I'm not going to do that. I have my stolz, I have my pride. Next day, offered me a cigarette from the pack.
Mm-hmm.
Believe that? So I went back to this chief, and he said, you go to proving grounds, Chernitza. we're shooting all kinds of ammunition, they're trying out the bazookas, whatever it was. You report to the chief, his name is Mr. Steller, he has a job for you. So I go over there and I shake. I don't know who the guy is. Is he a Nazi? He can do anything he wants with me. I go into the barrack, and he shakes hands with me. He says he is an anti-Nazi. I just won my life. And there's a girl, a young, pretty girl, German girl, sitting at a typewriter. So I looked at him, I looked at her, I said, are you crazy? You know, they're denouncing each other all the time. So don't worry, she thinks the way I do. What can I do for you? I said, God,
and
I don't believe.
And he was the chief of the...
of the proving grounds.
Chernitza,
Chef Chernitza. He was in civilian clothes, by the way.
Yeah.
He was not in... he was just a... later on, turned on, he was a garage mechanic. I found him after the war. Good-looking fellow. So he said, first he asked me to sit down on the chair. I sat on a chair after 2 years. I sat on the floor. So I almost cried, and he said, what can I do for you? So I thought fast. I said, I was working at the kitchen. I knew some girls there. If I could get to that, I'll get some extra food, and food means life. Could I maybe, because there's another group on the east side of that proving grounds, and they have 10 people there. So we get to the gate, and there's this assessment, a sergeant Rapportführer. So he'll attach me to the tent, I'll be the 11th, and the foreman will give me a little bit of soup, and that'll be the end of it. Could I go myself to pick it up? Mm-hmm. We said, let's go, let's find out. We'll go to the gate. When the gate, you know, were the barracks, and there was a gate, and there was a factory. He says, I'm going to insult you on the way. Laugh it off. I have to, for the other Nazis around here. I'm going to call your names, don't worry about it. He says, verfluchter Jude, blah, blah, and all this. And I said, kiss my foot. And we got to the gate, and there was one of ours, Schreiber, who was helping the SS man to keep track of all the movements of hundreds of people going in and out. He had an armband here saying Schreiber. I knew him. So he come in, and Steller says to him, yeah, they sent me this guy here. He's going to work for us. What is that? We start with a fresserai. He said, with the food. Oh, he said, 10 people there, it'll be 11 all set. So Steller says, you can't be. And Steller is a civilian. Mm-hmm. So the sergeant looks at him and says, who the hell are you to tell me what can be, cannot be? He says, wait a minute, not so fast. He's going to work us with the Germans. He's going to sit in the bunker and do some work which we are doing for us. And we are making lunch once at 12, once at 3, once at 11, once we don't make lunch at all if we have a lot of work. Now you want a Jewish prisoner to force us to have lunch when he's eating? Are you crazy? Like this. And I winked at our guy, the Schreiber. I said, come on, say something. So he says, what do you mean? What do you want me to do? Make commander of one person? He says, I don't give a damn. So I said, So he says, Herr Chef, was kann man denn machen? He says, Commander einer Person, gibt's denn sowas? He says, Commander one person, I don't give a damn, so what? Okay, so made me Commander one, I was going alone to work. There were 400 people in a group. When I got in the morning, I got up later. I didn't have to stand for a half hour and wait till they counted 400 people. And I got right to the window with the two assessments standing, and they were making fun of me. They said, bei dem stimmt immer der Vorderrichtung und die Seitenrichtung. In other words, nobody's missing. The row is always even this way and that way. Just get the hell out of here.
So what kind of work were you doing?
So I was sitting in a bunker. There was a German young 18-year-old Gestapo agent sitting there. He didn't want to sit in the bunker. So I had to go underground. That was the edge of the proving ground, sir. I had to go out about maybe 30 meters, 40, I don't know, 20, something like this. There was a little bunker, and I had to push out a target. The target was a square like this, or a rectangle, with little wires in here, and there were some screws in here. And I have to push it up above ground. About 30 meters behind me, in a little barrack was sitting Walter, who was shooting single two-centimeter bullets, I think, from a machine gun. And he had to sit at this, hit this target. Now, when I was supposed to direct him. When I brought it back down, I saw where he broke it. So he broke it too much to the right. I had a phone. The phone was only to this barrack, to the shooter. Mm-hmm. That's all. And I had a heater, electric heater. Mm-hmm. I was sat in the past. Well, no assessment could see me. Nobody could beat me. I just won my life. So I called up and said, Walter, schießen Sie mehr nach rechts. Because he sat, there was too much here.
Walter was a German.
Right? Yeah, a civilian.
Mm-hmm. How come they were in a proving ground and they were using civilians to do the shooting and the
testing? I have no idea. He was in civilian clothes. Mm-hmm. He had a Hakenkreuz here, but he was civilian. Well, the chief of the factory was also in civilian clothes. Maybe he was an assessment. I don't know.
Yeah.
Anyway, so when Walter wasn't shooting, I could take a nap. And nobody can catch me. Now Steller would come in, he asked me what I was doing, so I told him. So I said, these are fine, these pigs, what do they do to you? He says, what is the world going to say when we lose the war? I said, I hope so. I hope you lose it. They already probably knew they were losing it. Anyway, so Steller would come in, I heard the steps. He's the only one who could come in there, and he had a beautiful letter coat. Opens up his coat and takes out a 3-pound military bread, takes out a pocket knife, cuts it in half, says, half for you, half for me. He was like a brother. He was an anti-Nazi. And it was just like a dream. So Ezio Hirani brought me coupons for cigarettes for good work. So you could get a pack of cigarettes for I don't know how many coupons. So I didn't smoke, so I kept the cigarettes, and I had cigarettes when there were no cigarettes in camp. And the SS were buying it from us. They were giving us extra bread. And I could keep the bread in that little bunker. My brother worked from other bunkers. There were thousands of tons of ammunition. The German wasn't so good in math. My brother was, so he was running the shoulder. So he also got sometimes some
extra piece of bread. But she was what? I didn't get it.
There were ammunition storages, big storages of ammunition. Mm-hmm. Somebody had to keep track of it. Mathematically. Uh-huh. So my brother was doing that. Uh-huh. And he came down. Also, we were stealing zuckerrieben, that means
sugar.
Our guys were stealing sugar beets on a railroad station. So we exchanged with them for cigarettes, and we could, or some other stuff, and it had to be cooked. I mean, you're not allowed to cook on the stove in the barrack, but Walter had a stove, and so he was my cook. He was cooking for me. And so my brother came down and had lunch together. Anyway, it was just fantastic. I didn't know what I was doing because I knew when he broke that little wire, some kind of a thing fell down in the office, and I think they figured out the speed of the bullet or something. They wouldn't tell me. I didn't know. There were 2-centimeter anti-aircraft bullets. I think that's what it was. So I kept all, whatever I had, some extra bread or cigarettes, I kept it in my place of work, because if I kept it on my pillow and on my bag, they'll steal it. It's obvious, people are hungry. That was going on till, one day before they took us away from Schlieben. The guard knew me because that was the end of the proving grounds. The good SS guard was walking back and forth. So one day he calls me, says, "Du, come on here." "Hab keine Angst, don't worry." He says, "Come, I want to talk to you." I said, "To me?" Yeah, don't worry, come on. "The war is over," he says. "Germany lost the war." Listen, an assessment talks to me. And I says, "Yeah, I see you're a smart fellow." He says, "Get another 10 guys. We walk out of here, we're at the end of it anyway here. I'll escort you to the Americans. I'll save your life, and then you'll tell the Americans I sold your life and you'll sell mine. It's a deal?" I said, "Of course. What am I supposed to say? No, shoot me." I avoided him like the pest, never saw him again. And when I saw him, he's coming. I went the other way around and got on the bus. And then one day, they made a roll call and ride straight to the trains. Then I had some extra bread, they had cigarettes. It was all scooped. I left it.
Yeah.
And they took us away because the front was getting new, I guess. They took us to Bautzen. We were there maybe a day.
Bautzen,
B-A-U-T-Z-E-N. There was a factory of a railroad cars or something, a street cars and railroad cars. We were there maybe a day, and they took us now on a tortoise march. That march, that death march.
Death march.
About 20 hours walking, 2 hours resting there, sitting somewhere, whatever. And we were walking, and a colleague of mine, who was with me, yeah, and they had a horse and a buggy behind the group. We were maybe 200 people. I'm dry with it. I need something to drink.
Some water.
Yeah,
thank
you.
Would you like?
Yeah. So where am I now?
You were on tortoise march.
Yeah, so from Bautzen we had to walk. So they had a horse and buggy behind, and who had trouble with his feet or something, said they'll just sit on a horse, on a buggy there, and they'll take. It was a nice little thing. So a fellow, I saw they, when the buggy was full, the horse and buggy was full, they took it up the little hill there, over hills there. And we heard shooting.
They shot everybody.
They were killing those people. And all of a sudden, we were walking, and one fellow comes without a breath, stands next to me in my room. "I just escaped that." I said, "What happened?" I said, "They were shooting us, but I saw they were repeating the gun, so I started to run down the hill. Zigzagging, they were shooting after him, but he didn't get me." So he's coming back and he's standing next to me, and the captain, the leader of our group, the SS man, is standing and waiting and looking who escaped. So I said, "Oh God, now he'll mistake me for you and I'll get out and I'll be shot." And he noticed him. He says, "Kannst du laufen?" He had his shoe was rubbing against his leg or something. So I figured, why should I walk? I can ride a, but he was okay. So he looks at him with a smile, says, "Kannst du laufen?" He says, "Yeah, everything okay, I can walk, nothing happened." He let him go. And we came to Nixdorf, in Czech, Nixdorf. It's in Sudetenland, called Mikulášovice in Czech.
I'm pooped, I have.
Oh. Today is November 16, 1994. This is Edith Milman continuing with the interview with Professor Filar. Professor Filar, last when we talked, you were mentioning Nixdorf, when you got to Nixdorf. Could you please continue?
Yes, that was toward the end of 1944, could have been November maybe or October, something like this. We got there after a horrible march where they were killing people who couldn't make it. We arrived there, that was not a, that place was empty, there were barracks there, there was no any,
no fences,
nothing. It was a private, for private people who they brought from France, you know.
Interview with Professor Filar. We are continuing. Okay.
So we got the Nixdorf. We were a group maybe of 150 people, 200, just about this. And then these were private barracks where they kept French civilians, which they brought from France to work there, and they were gone already. So there was no fence, nothing. It was just a civilian camp. So the camp was guarded by the SS. There were plenty of them, you know, standing almost next to every door, every window. They kept good eyes on it. And they took us to work, and they took us outside or somewhere, and we had to dig ditches, and they said we're digging ditches against American tanks. Turned out it wasn't against American tanks, but the Polish army came from Russia, from east. And the mayor of that little town, whoever it was, gave us an appreciation, in parentheses, gave us a little mail soup, it was called some soup, mail of flour, whatever it was. But the soup was so horrible that everybody was running to the latrine all night. And I'm still running ever since. That's those years. I don't know what the devil it was. Anyway, when we first started running at night and everybody wanted to go across to the latrine, the SS put the guns on us. They said, we're creating a revolution. So we said, if you won't let us go to the latrine, the barracks will swim away. They finally realized what we won, they let us go. So we were digging there, and it was the last day of the war already. And then all of a sudden, one day, we see a little 10-year-old, about 10-year-old German boy walks around there. There was only one guard, I think it was. We were not 200. We were in a group of us where there could have been 20 or something. So one guard was there, another place, there was another guard. So this German little boy walked around, and he had a coat, and inside the coat he was showing me, I saw it, he just came up to me, he showed me a paper, a newspaper. He wants to give me a newspaper. So I figured it's some provocation or something, I was afraid. And there were cut woods there, you know, big trees were lying on the ground. So I said, when a guard goes away, put it between the trees and get lost. So he did, and then when the guard didn't see, I took it out, put it under my coat, and we got back to the barracks. Guess what it was? It was May 1st, 1945, big headline, Berlin gefallen. Berlin was taken. Oh God, so we don't understand why our boy shows this. Well, we found him after liberation. And we asked him, he said his father was killed by the Nazis in a concentration camp. He was German. So he wanted to give us some hope. A little boy, so he brought us that paper. So he became our mascot. Anyway, so, but how we were liberated, so that was going on every day. It was just a few days. Then one night, it must have been about 4 in the morning, the daybreak started just coming, and I go over to the latrine, and I think I see different faces. I couldn't stand up and look in his face. But I said, well, old man, with guns. So I come back, and I was sleeping on a floor with my brother under a table. Said it was protection from the table or something. And I said, Ulek, I think the SS is gone. Look like old guys at her. I said, shh, let me go take a look. Well, let's be careful about it, because some guys, they'll find out that this, they might start jumping for joy or something, could be the Volkssturm, and they might get scared and kill us. So he went in there and out and came back, said, it's Volkssturm, that's it. So it was quiet, we just shushed like this, and then, you know, about 7 or so, they opened the windows, and they there, and they smile, old guys. I said, oh, you're going to be free, you're going to live. Oh, wait a minute, I forgot. Before this happened, the chief of SS, or the Gestapo, came to our camp just a few days before, and he said, he promised us solemnly we will all be killed. He said in Germany, you'll all be killed. Quite a story about this guy later on. So then they got lost, and the Volkssturm came in, and so on, as I told you. Then, maybe an hour later, a Volkssturm evaporated, and there was nobody there. So among us were a couple of Germans who were prisoners, Social Democrats. Our Lagerelster, the leader of our camp, was a German, Mr. Seidel, I think, had his signature.
What was his name? Could you spell?
I think. Yeah, among us were a few Germans who were Social Democrats, and our Lagerelster, that means the leader of our group, was a German Social Democrat. His name was Seidler. So he said, let's do a roll call, see if anybody is missing. So we did a roll call, and one was missing. I look around, my brother is missing. Then we look, it was a little hill up there on the Sudetenland, and I see my brother coming toward us on a bicycle. He was already in town, and just kicked a German something, took a bike from him, came down and said, what are you doing here, doing a roll call? We are free, the Polish army is on Main Street. So we yelled hurrah, we came out there, and that's what it was. So I became friendly with the lieutenant, who was from Limburg, about my size, my age at that time. And where we were now, they put Germans in that camp, and we knocked on doors and asked for a room.
That was the Polish army that was fighting with the Russians, right?
Yeah, no, yeah. But they were a separate unit. There were no Russians between them.
Uh-huh.
But they were just Poles.
Poles.
Yeah,
okay.
they came from Russia. Anyway, so we knocked on doors, and the Germans first were afraid, and they begged us to come in. Why? Because we put a sign on the door saying, in Polish, former prisoners of war here, please don't disturb. Because someplace else, they didn't see the sign, they go in, kick the door in, and let the Germans have it. They paid them back a little bit. As a matter of fact, I was together with my brother, who was a widow in that little house. So the Germans came from across the street, and he said, you're uncomfortable, why don't one of you come stay with us? I said, get the hell out of here. You know what they wanted? They wanted a little sign on the door. So one day I'm sitting there, we're eating, she cooked us. She was a very fine old woman. And she told us that they were afraid because they talked with the SS. It looks like that's the end of the war. They'll be liberated. They'll kill us. But they understood. Normally we should have killed them for what they did to us. So the SS told her, don't worry about it. I'll be finished tonight. They had set up the machine guns. About 2 in the morning we were supposed to be all shot. But it was a breakthrough in the front. And that's how they had to run about 10, 11 o'clock at night. And that's why they ran away. So this Tadek was his name. He was from Lemberg. And he didn't know any German, and I did. So he was the leader of that camp and the guardhouse. So he said, you'll be my interpreter. So fine. So one day we're eating the soup about 1 o'clock or so. And a sergeant comes on a bike and says, out of breath, says, come on. Tadek is waiting for you. I said, what happened? He said, we called the chief of Gestapo. I said, what? How'd you get him? I said, I don't know. Talk to him. So I almost choked on the soup, pushed myself up on the table around me, jumped out of the guardhouse. Here he is. Now he ain't so splendid. Doesn't look so tough and not so big anymore. He's in civilian clothes, scared stiff, sitting on a chair. He must have been 10 feet tall or something. When he was sitting on a chair and the lieutenant was sitting on a table with a whip in his hand, he was taller than the lieutenant. That's how big he was. I said, how did you get him? Oh, he says, Germans came in here and they said, they're great enunciators. And they said, you're picking a little fish, why don't you pick on a big one? He says, yeah, like who? He said, like the chief of Gestapo of Switzerland. Well, you know his address, you know where he lives? Sure, they gave him the address, so he sent out a couple of jeeps, whatever, with soldiers. They got him and they brought him in here sitting, shaking, scared, stiff. So Tadek says to me, okay, go ahead, ask him for all the names of Gestapo and SS, so on, and the addresses. So I did, but he couldn't talk. He was ringing when he did that's how he was sitting scared. So I said to him, don't you see, he's cold, we gotta warm him up. So we went to work on him. We started to beat the hell out of him. And I said to him, how do you like your own medicine? That's the way you were beating us, now you're getting a little back of it. Do you like it? He found it. A sergeant came with a bucket. Yeah, a bucket of water, threw water at him, brought him back too, we beat more of him. Finally, when he started to talk, he was such a coward that I couldn't write so fast the way he talked. So I said, shut up. I said, you talk too fast. I can't write that fast. Finally, we pumped everything out of him. We took him outside, and he was only falling on his knees, holding his hands to a prayer. He said, lassen Sie mich doch bitte leben. Please let me live. I said, you pig, you want to live? Why were you born? How many people did you murder? You want to live? You're kidding. So Tata gives me his machine gun, or gun, whatever it was. I think it was a little machine gun. So he said, go ahead. I said, I can't do it. I'm not a murderer. He said, you're a coward? I said, no, slow down. I'm not a coward. But I cannot kill anybody in cold blood. Let him jump at me in self-defense, I will, but otherwise I can't do it. I'm not a Nazi. And he stood there yelling. I said, shut up, you pig. And so the sergeant with us, and he killed me. That was the end of one Nazi.
So that was a Polish sergeant that killed
him? Yeah. Then I was looking for a piano. I wanted to start playing the piano. So we went to the mayor somewhere. They gave me a key to a palace. It was a big Nazi lived there, and he ran away. And there was a concert grand, a beautiful piano in there. Oh yeah, before I went, I got to tell you, I forgot. I took a friend of mine, and I said, I had a cut finger. This finger was cut in camp. I was sitting on my head and I flew the finger right in the knife. And it healed up, thank God. So I said, I want to find out if I'll be able to play. I knew it, I will on the table, it didn't hurt, but I wanted to try a piano. So I said, let's go to a nice neighborhood, maybe somebody has a piano there and I'll try. So we went, we knocked on the door, a German sopped up, scared stiff. I said, don't be afraid, we're not murder, we're not Nazis. You were Nazis, we're not. I see you have a piano there. It was a long hallway, it's an upright piano. I said, I'm a concert pianist, I'm not a murderer. I was not a murderer. I said, I had an injured finger. I want to see if I'd be able to play. Well, come on in.
So I wanted to help on the piano, and I tried, and said, oh yeah, thank God, I'll play. So he says, so bleiben Sie doch hier, spielen Sie was. Sit down, play something. I said, get lost. Yeah. And we walked out. Then I got this key to this palace, and there was a concert Bessendorf, I think, a beautiful piano, and I started to play. I played 5 minutes, and I couldn't move my arms. It hurt. It was murder. I was doing physical work, and this is finger, all the fine muscles. But I thank God I knew what to do. So I played the first day 10 minutes and I went home, so to speak. Next day I tried for 20 minutes, 30 minutes.
Now where was all that?
In Schliemann, in that place where we were liberated. We were there for a few weeks maybe. Another thing. Then came an order.
You say Schliemann. I think the last
not
time.
Not Schliemann, Nixdorf. I keep mixing it up. I'm sorry.
Okay. When were you in Schlieben? You were in Schlieben before.
Right. From Buchenwald we went to
Schlieben. Schlieben.
Right. Yeah. Because we were longer in Schlieben. That was just a few weeks.
Yeah. So that was all in Nixdorf.
Yeah, Nixdorf. It's Mikulaszewice now in Czech. So on the same street across another house, a colleague of mine lived there. We used to see each other, talk. And there were two German women from Bautzen. And they said they love music, could they come? They heard that I'm playing somewhere, could they? Said, you want to? Okay. So they came and they listened a couple of times. And one day there came an announcement from the army that all the Germans, the war is over, the Germans have to go back home, no refugees anymore. Turned out that they had a jewelry store in Dalton, a big one. I didn't know that, but this woman, she some kind felt that I'm a decent human being, so she came up to me and said, we have to go back. We are afraid because we have two suitcases full of jewelry from our jewelry store. And there are poles all over and later Germans, could you go with us? We'll give you something for this. That was about 20 kilometers or 30 kilometers.
So they were originally from Belsen and they found themselves.
No, they were from Bautzen.
Yeah, that's what I mean. From Belsen. And they found themselves.
Bautzen.
Bautzen.
Right. B-A-U. U-T-Z-E-N.
Okay. Bautzen.
That's right.
And they found themselves in Nixdorf as refugees?
Right.
Okay.
All right. So I asked my brother, they say they'll give me something, a coat or this or that or whatever, a watch. Oh, they'll give me a watch for me and for my brother. Who had a watch? Nothing. So I asked my brother, what do you think, what should I do? Oh yeah, they'll give me a bicycle so I won't have to walk. All right. And they'll walk with a little pushcart and put the stuff on it. I said, what should I do? You think I should go? I said, go ahead. You want to go? Go. Well, nothing's going to happen. So I went, and we just came out of and they put this stuff on that little pushcart, and I was going front, and I was riding slowly in a bit. We came out about a couple of kilometers outside of that little town, and there comes out of the forest, come the Polish guard out with a gun and says, what the hell, what are you doing here? So I said in Polish, I just talked them out of it, and he let us go. So we went out, and they got scared, and they saw that what I talked to him at work, so they stopped. They said, I want to take those two little suitcases, put it on my bicycle in a bag. They had a little, space for luggage with a little spring and all that. Mm-hmm. So they did it. I could hardly ride when I got over. It was maybe 40, 50 pounds, I don't remember. And we were going up and down our hills there, and I thought about it. They rubbed us clean.
Who?
The Germans, the stuff which then these two suitcases which I have on my bike now, could be all rubbed stuff. All I have to do is turn around, go down a hill, and I'm snowing you.
Yeah.
I said, but I'm not a thief. I can't do it. I fought with myself. I said, I didn't have a penny, nothing. We were robbed. I said, here, I can get something back. I couldn't do it. And I brought him back to Bautzen. We came that night. We came that night, I saw the house, I remember the street, Seminarstrasse 13, entrance was on a corner and there was a big window here and a big window here, it must have been a big place. Well, the neighbors came out, blah, blah, it was night already. So they said, you cannot go back at night, you stay over, we'll give you a motorcycle in the morning. And my husband had a motorcycle. I didn't know how to ride a motorcycle and on top there was no gas. But I came out there and I saw pictures of the police, German police there. I said, must have been some real Nazi. He said, was I a dope? I didn't make a U-turn and go back. Yeah. I should have done it. And my colleagues later laughed, said, she knew what to pick. She picked you, should have picked me. You should have said 50-50, what the hell?
Yeah.
Anyway, so she gave me a raincoat. What else? She gave me a pin. She said that's a pin which with a little pearl on it. It wasn't pearl, it was baloney. And she gave me two cheap watches and a pair of pants. I think that was it.
Mm-hmm. And you went back. And you went back to your next step.
Then we took off after a while and we decided to go to Prague. And the trains were free, everything we could go on. So we came to Prague and the Czech government was wonderful to us. They were liberated themselves. So they gave us a hotel where to stay in Center City. It was an empty hotel. They cleared it up. I don't know who was there before. I found out later. That was pretty funny, too. It was a whorehouse there in the war for German soldiers. Oh. They cleaned it up. I'll tell you how I found out. You'll laugh. Anyway, so, and they gave us list key, those little stamps, so we could ride the streetcars for free, go to a restaurant and pay with those stamps.
So when you say we, is it you and your brother?
No,
or are there
all of us who came there, you know, refugees. Yeah. And one day I went for a walk with a friend of mine from camp. He was an engineer. And we walked down the street and we see a beautiful building and it says the Česká Philharmonia, Czech Philharmonic. I said, hey, a concert hall. Let's go take a look. I didn't see one for so many years. So there's a doorman there in a uniform, big tall guy. So I said, could we go in? We were just liberated. They were very nice to us. Could we go? I'm a pianist, I said. I didn't see a concert hall for 5 years. Could we go in and take a look how it looks? Oh, you're lucky because the orchestra is having a rehearsal. Oh, yeah. I said, who's conducting? So he says, Kubelik. Kubelik? I said, Kubelik is dead. He was a great violinist. That's right, but that's his son, Raphael. He's a conductor and he was a pianist too. So we walked in there, and sure enough, they were rehearsing, they were playing. We sat down quietly. They were playing the Dvořák Symphony from the New World. And my pal, after a while, says to me, okay, let's go. I said, you go, I'll stay. So he left. And after it was over, I went backstage, introduced myself to the conductor, the Kubelik, and I told him who I was just liberated. Now I repeated a Chopin E minor piano concerto. I said, maybe I'll play for him. Just got a wild idea.
Yeah.
So he says, oh yeah, I told him he knew my teacher. Javitsky was known all over Europe. So he said, I'll tell you what, the pianos are now, you know, they're on the side, they're without legs. We just liberate ourselves. I'm just organizing the orchestra. We don't have a Philharmonic. Why don't you come Saturday to my home? They'll play for me there. He gave me his address, 5 o'clock. I said, fine, so I went there Saturday, and I found a place for the practice. I went to the conservatory, I think. I came in there, he wasn't home yet, his wife was there, she was very nice, and she said, my husband is having auditions for new members of the orchestra. He called you and said, he'll be back soon, you can warm up now a little bit if you want to. And there was a student of his name was Ilya Hurnik, who was studying with him composition. And then she also showed me the Stradivarius of Kubelik's father, in this music room, and was hanging like this from a, you know, on a chair, in a glass enclosure. That was the Stradivarius, a beautiful instrument. So I practiced, he finally came in, he was tall, he was a golden human being. I'm telling you, pure gold, that man, I love it. Took his coat off, said, oh, I'm sorry, I said, you know, we were just liberating ourselves, blah, 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 all this. So I said, I'm playing. So I played an E minor concerto from memory. So he looks at me, can't believe, he says, wait a minute. When did you see the music? Where's your music? Music burned in Warsaw, together on my piano. Mean you didn't see this music for 5 years? That's right. You didn't make one mistake. Sorry, I apologize. So he says, it's unbelievable. I said, you play with me. Where do you live? Wait a minute. What do you eat? What is it? I mean, what do you do with yourself? How do you exist? So I told him the city was so nice to us, gave us a hotel where we stayed there. I said, what's the name of the hotel? I told him. He started to laugh. I said, Mr. Kubelik, what is so funny? He said, what's so funny? During the war, it was a whorehouse for the German soldiers. So I said, when I get back there, I'll look on my bed. Maybe one was left. So, and then one day, and we ate, there was a Jewish committee there. And so we ate lunch there. So I think I went to practice, so when I came back, about 12 for lunch, whatever it was, my brother wasn't there yet. So I talked to some friends, and you know, we just talked a little bit. And then a man comes up and kind of interrupts a little bit our conversation about my age. He
Yeah, just kind of buds in it, you know. So I stepped back and I looked at him and I said, I know that guy. And I scratched my head and I said, I know him. Who is he?
It's my cousin.
Tom Visco, they had a factory. I was there last time. I was 10 years old. A good 15 years ago. So I said, wait a minute. Is your name Yaskovich? He says, right. From Viskov? Yeah. Bicycle factory? Right. You don't recognize me? So he looked when I fell inside his arms. We didn't see each other so many years. So he says, well, I saw your brother yesterday. I said, I know, Yulek be here any minute. Yulek is alive? Who the hell are you talking about? I was 2 days ago in the lodge. I saw Michael. He came back from Siberia. He said, Michael is alive? God. So when Yulek came in, I told him this the same night we were on a train, a freight train. No ticket, nothing. We rode all night. About 6 o'clock, we came into lodge. Then all we had was a little rucksack. You know, we don't have anything. So my brother said, 6:30, he says, you stay here, I'll go look for him. I said, I want to go look for him. He says, you're the youngest, I'm the oldest, so you sit and I go. Okay, so he went, left me here, and I sat there, half asleep. And all of a sudden, I see that one of my rucksacks is moving away. He moves away on his own power. I see a Soviet soldier, that thief, stuck his foot into those, those belts.
Yeah.
And he was dragging it away like this. I said, hey, you bum, that's mine. Oh, he said, he just got it on my foot. I said, yeah, sure. Okay, so my brother went to the city and found out where the committee is. It was about 7 in the morning. Everything was closed. So I went into the Brahma, you know, to the hallway there. It was all white, so people wrote names where they are. So he looked, and he found Michael Filar Zavatska 27 and Dr. Malamed. So 15 to 20 minutes later, he was there, knocked on the door, and they were in the partisans. So the old grandmother survived too. And she
opened. Your grandmother? No.
No, Dr. Malamed's mother.
Oh, I see.
We didn't know her. Mm-hmm. So, but all the people get up early, so she opened the door on the chain. So he says, my brother says, does Mr. Filar live here? That's right, buddy, he's still asleep. Why don't you come a little later? So she said, you don't mind. It's my brother. I didn't see him in 5 years. So she said, oh, and she opened the door, and he went in there in the living room. He was sleeping on a sofa, and his foot was sticking out from under the cover. So Joe, he was tickling his foot a little bit. Michael opened his eyes, saw his brother. And I sit there half asleep on a railroad station. All of a sudden, I see two of them coming at me. I am rebuilding my piano. It's part of.
But let's continue now.
Well, so we stayed there for a while. I found a colleague from in lodge. I found that we stayed there together, squeezed in. You know. So I found a colleague from went to the concerts and all that, and I found a colleague, a Polish colleague of mine, a very dear friend. And I met the conductor of the symphony, Zdzisław Guzyński, was the director of the Philharmonic.
Guzyński.
You might know the name, he was pretty famous. And I auditioned for him, he gave me a concert. And I played the E minor concerto with Guzyński. And guess who was at that concert? The director of the Warsaw Conservatory was in lodge. And he came to the concert, came backstage, invited me for lunch. A great, great man. I have a picture. His name was Professor Eugenius Morawski. Oh, he was a famous man. He was the director of the conservatory and I was a student there. So he invited me for lunch. He said to me, remember when you were a young fellow at the conservatory, I called you into my office, I always liked you, remember that? I sure do. What did I tell you then? You told me to get out of Poland and go west, and you believed in me, I'll make a great career. I'm telling you again the same thing right now. Get out. I believe in you. You have nothing to do here. You beat it, get outside, and you will make a great career. And I'm encouraging you to go. I said, director, you didn't tell anybody? We're already packed. We're leaving tomorrow morning. And we went to Berlin on the way to Frankfurt. And we stopped in Berlin, and my brothers went to a committee, Jewish committee for something, and I wanted to see the Reichstag, which was burned out by the Nazis. They said the Reds burned it down. It was a whole so very famous building. Yeah. So we decided to meet about 1 o'clock for lunch with them. Must have been 11 in the morning, whatever. And I went there. It was a good part of it was destroyed, even there were some stairs left, and there were some ugly things with the Russian put. There was one head of one president or something, and they did something on top of his head.
Oh.
It was right. It was really funny to see it. I went up the stairs, and there was an old German who worked there, and there were some officers. I think there were French, Russians, English, Americans probably, but I didn't know any English, but I knew French and I knew some Russian. And I saw that whatever the old German were telling him, it was a very historic building. They didn't understand a word. I could see it. So I said to the French, to the Russians, I can translate from German to French and Russian. Oh, God sent you here. The French said it, not the Russians. The Russians didn't believe in God. So I was translating for a while, and then the Russian, the old German, must have been in his 80s. He said, there's nothing much left here. It's all destroyed. Why don't we go over to the Reichskanzler, the Reichschancellery of Hitler? That stands. It's now gone, you know. And everything intact. So they said, fine, but they pointed on me and said, you must go with us. I said, I'll be delighted. Mm-hmm. But a chance that I had a little DKV today is called the Audi.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those four little zeros in front. And I had a four seater, so we must have been about 20 people. So they had a driver there, so I went back and forth. It was about 3 minute ride one way. He came back. And the two of us, the German and I, were sitting in the back and two officers in the front. So on that short ride, the German says to me, Zinzi, ein Russe, are you Russian? I said, sure, straight from Moscow. I didn't want to talk to him. We arrived there, they're waiting, and there was no entrance for civilians, but it was generals, colonels, who, I don't know who the American, what rank the Americans and English were, but I knew the French and the Russians, some. So they didn't bother us. The four guards were there, the Americans, the English, the French, and the Russians. And we walked in, and we walked in. I saw it on TV several times. You walk in there, and there was first the Nazi party room, was, I don't know, maybe 40, 50 meters long, maybe 100 feet, something like this. A long, long table of chairs on one side. The end of it was Hitler's room. And I walked in, I'll never forget it, I was shaken to see this. On the left was his desk, on the right was a stand with his globus, where he was looked on. Chaplin played with a globus in the movie, remember yourself? And a chandelier. Beautiful chandelier hanging, a long one, hanging down to almost, you almost could touch of your head. And one of the Russians looked to me like he would be Jewish. I wanted to tell him that I was Jewish too, and didn't know how. Finally got an idea. And there was a moment, and I said to him, Colonel, what do you think? What don't you think it's a beautiful Hanukkah lamp? So he said, da-da, konechno. He says, yeah, sure, and he smiled. I knew who he was. You know, and then was a little room down on the side. There was a sink, you know, just a little washroom, and also a military bed, I guess, a pritzer. How is a pritzer in English?
A cot,
which was hanging out from the wall.
Mm-hmm.
You open it up. They say you stay overnight sometimes. Then a German came out from the garden, and he said, why don't you go to the bunker? Down there, we committed suicide. So we went out and went down about two flights in concrete, and there was no electricity. You know, everything was bombed out. So who smoked out a lighter or matches? I smoked at a time, said matches, and the German pointed to the door. He said, this is where he this is the room where he committed suicide. So we went over. There was a wide door, and it was locked. And so all the officers, big guys, you know, about 6-7 footers, and they tried to open it. It was closed. And we, what do you mean it's closed? Let's open it up. So I squeezed in between them. And the Russian said, давай открывай. Раз, два, три. We say, 1, 2, 3 in the French. You know, 112 English, 1, 2, 3, whatever, I could understand that. And I said, woo, and I was pushing, and I said to one of the officers, you know, when I was in Buchenwald, I didn't dream I will break down that door. It was just it's unbelievable. And we finally broke it down. We walked in there. It was a mess. There were a lot of people saying, Strang Geheim, top secret. Everybody was taking souvenirs, but I knew I have to go to Frankfurt. That means a couple of hundred kilometers or more over the Russian zone. And if they catch with me with something like this, they call me a spy, and instead of Frankfurt, the Americans, so I go to Siberia, so I didn't take anything. But we got through, and I could have taken. And it's still eating my heart when I think about it. And we made it to Frankfurt.
But what was in this bunker that you could have taken?
It said Strang Geheim. I don't know what it was.
Oh,
I wouldn't
remember. Oh, it was Geheim. It said
Strang Geheim. Yeah, the top secret.
Top
it was
secret
lying
things.
All over the floor with matches and lighters, so we couldn't see much. They took it. I didn't want to look at it. I said, I know it's poison to me if I take it. So then we got to Frankfurt. There was a DP camp outside of Frankfurt called Salzheim. We went
what
in there.
What was it called? Salzheim?
Pardon me?
What was it called? I need to...
Salzheim. Z-E-I-L-S-H-E-I-M.
Okay, Salzheim.
And they kicked the Americans kicked the Germans out of a few streets, and they gave us the houses to live.